you can't arrive at the age of 70 without reflection. Those of you who've hit all the zero numbers, 40, 50, 60, 30, all of those, know what I'm talking about. But 70 is something else. I'll tell you what's so interesting about all the other numbers. 40, 50, it's what time do I have left to do all the things I want to do. 60 is how do I begin to wrap it up. 70 is like, now what? You know? It's a really strange time, and all of my friends are turning 70, so we have this dialogue, which is quite a fascinating dialogue. It's a summing up in so many ways. And coming to grips with, or making peace with, or not making peace with, what has gone on for the previous 70 years. You know, I'm not going to have a big career move at this point, at least that's not anticipated. You know, maybe some vacations or trips, I don't know. Visiting my kids, seeing my granddaughter, of course, pretty much are near the top of the list of expectations and hopes. And, you know, as I've indicated in the last month or two, you know, managing the discomforts of getting old, which are very real. But one of the things that I think a lot of people are still looking for is some kind of resolution, some kind of arrival at something that somehow always seems not to be there, hasn't been there your entire life, and you have probably never arrived there. And you still think, well, it's coming. If I do this, if I do that, I mean, there's fewer and fewer strategies left to figure out how you're going to get there, but they're still there in the planning part of your brain. And kind of what begins to happen when you're 70, if you're lucky, is you realize that there's no there to get to. In the best of worlds, you realize you're there. In a sense that you've always been there, which makes no sense because it's so imperfect. How do you get there and accept it when it doesn't feel like it's what you really wanted or how you expected it to be or what you were praying it might become? So for many people there's a kind of dissatisfaction, or the glass is half empty kind of perspective, or the glass is half full, but in either case that half thing is a problem. You know, why half? Why not the whole thing? I think the great spiritual teachers from the beginning of time have a simple message. The glass is full, has always been full. Period. And the failure to recognize that, which is not a failure, it's a process, is something that starts to evolve. If you're lucky, you recognize it or realize it. If not, you continue to struggle to get there. Life is about that struggle. The world that we live in, this manifested world, is made up of our struggle. It wouldn't come into being, it wouldn't be built, it wouldn't thrive, it wouldn't have reality without our disappointments, frustrations, desires, needs, obstructions, and ability to struggle. We are the part of existence, that part of God that builds life. That's what we do. And what we go through in building life is what God goes through in building life, which is, it's hard. You go from design to construction. Design may seem hard, but building it is harder. How do you build a life? How do you get it right? Well, the way the universe works is that a lot of things don't get built right. It's an endless experimentation, figuring it out, building this extraordinary space that we live in. How do we get it right? And then you kind of realize, if you're lucky, that it's not about the getting it right. The building is all that matters. It's the ongoing construction of reality. We, the builders of reality. And that which has put us into this position, or commissioned us, if you will, to build reality, really, really is grateful to us. It really loves us for what we're doing. Some of us get to know that while we're in process. Some people get to know it at the last moment of their life. You know, there is a kind of moment that I used to sense of all of us, one at a time, in the middle of this stadium. And the stadium is filled with all of your ancestors. All of them. And they are cheering for you like mad. One cheering you on and one applauding you for what you were able to do. Not how much you did, but that you did at all. That you came into being. There is this enormity of gratitude for your being here. And sometimes you get to feel that while you're still in the middle of it. You get to hear this quiet roar in the background going, "Go, girl. Do it. Do it." It absolutely understands the obstructions that exist and how hard it is and how much failure there is, because there is more failure than success in terms of outcome. But it doesn't seem to care, because it's all about the effort and the work that you do in life, whatever it is. I mean, it seems crazy to think that cleaning your house has any kind of cosmic value, but it does. Getting in the shower every day and cleaning your body, going to the supermarket, seem like unbearably mundane events, but they are the very stuff of life. And when you start to realize what's going on, you know, you walk into the supermarket and it's not just, "Oh my God, I got to get some soup or something, or pick up laundry detergent." It's like, where did all this come from? How did it become so available? You know, I don't know if you remember Khrushchev walking into a supermarket in the 50s, and he was kind of overwhelmed. He had never in the Soviet Union seen that kind of cornucopia of stuff, ever. So available, so easily available to people. And we walk in the supermarket and say, "They don't have tomato soup. The one thing I came in for, they don't have." And you walk out furious, because of, it's not even half empty, it's like everything is empty. You know, you just feel this enormous frustration in life because it doesn't have what you want. It has everything you need. It has everything you need. And there's a way to learn that, and there's a way to arrive at that. Coming to the age of 70, if you can do it without being caught up in what didn't happen, in your frustrations, in your limitations, in your discomforts, if you can possibly do that, coming to the age of 70 is a very blessed experience. In truth, waking up every day is a very blessed experience. But the hitting 70 makes you stop and look at it. The truth is, from the day I met Rudy, I've started to look at life as a blessed experience. And as I've said to you guys many times, Rudy said, what I'm teaching you is something you must do for the rest of your life. And that you need the muscle of youth to become established so that it will be working when you're older, because it's really hard to put in play when you're 70. Really hard. I think it's almost impossible. So I was given an opportunity to begin to grow this muscle that has had unbelievably beautiful unfolding aspect in my life. I was with Rudy on his last birthday, which was his 45th. And he brought all of us together. And it was such a big birthday, the party part of it was so big, he couldn't do it in one day, and he had a huge house. In one sitting, we had two halves. You were either invited to the first half or the second half. But the class before him was all of his students. And he sat there, and he was beaming a kind of light that was like, I don't think anything I'd seen before. It was so full, so fulfilled, so complete, so absolute and beautiful. And our light that was pouring back was equal to that. He encouraged us and brought from us a kind of love that was unlike anything I had known. Although he would tell me, he said, Bruce, the love you're looking for is what you feel for your mother when you're 4 years old. That's the love you're seeking. In a sense, Rudy's birthday was perfect. I know he sensed it as perfect. I also sensed that he knew it was his last. And that was a very big deal. Somehow he was going to be leaving us within a month. Not that I'm planning that myself. But you never know. You never know. But I could feel it winding up. And this week, that happened for me. Not again announcing a departure, but this birthday has become for me an experience of what I can only call as perfection. And it was engineered by my amazing wife and by my children. And it happened. I mean, it's already in a way past tense, but it's still present tense, as you can, because you guys are a huge part of it. But I'll just tell you a story, which is what I'm prone to do. My son Josh decided for my birthday that he would give me a gift, and he came up with this idea about 4 or 5 years ago, and even told me that he had come up with it 4 or 5 years ago, and he would give it to me when the time was ripe. So I couldn't get too caught up in that exactly. But as we drew closer to this, he said, Dad, I'm taking you somewhere. On your birthday, I need 2 days. And we'll do it the 2 days before your birthday, or 2 days before before your birthday. And I said, okay. You know, I mean, I really love my son, and I trust him totally. I don't know why. But I do. And so Blanche drove me to the airport on Thursday and gave me a ticket to Milwaukee. I had no idea why I was going to Milwaukee. I had no interest whatsoever in going to Milwaukee. I had been told to bring warm clothes, so I did that. But I didn't know where I was going or how long a flight it would be. And I arrive in Milwaukee, and Josh is there to greet me at the airport. He flew in from Seattle, and we rented a car. And he said, whatever we're doing is happening tomorrow morning, so let's go have dinner. And he said he looked up the best restaurants in Milwaukee and found the best. And we went there for dinner. And at this restaurant on the menu, and it was a lovely, beautiful restaurant, there was, what was the name of the restaurant?
Sanford.
Yeah, it was wonderful. But on the menu is this chef's surprise. So I figured this is a weekend of surprises. We'll have the chef's surprise. And it was seven courses, and every one was more remarkable than the one before. Endless unfolding of surprise. No expectation. And this extraordinary sense of being with my son. And the joy of that. We had never taken a trip together except when he was little. So this was like really one-on-one time together. And we just talked and talked, and of course it was all about a summing up of what my life had been and how we had gotten to this moment. And it continued the next morning when we woke up. And it was interesting. Josh started asking me these questions about a period of my life that were vague to him. And that period is when I was in my mid-20s, and I had just graduated from college. I had, to work through part of my last year of college, gotten a job at the World's Fair in New York. And it was a big World's Fair. And my girlfriend at the time's father worked the concession stands there, selling beer and hot dogs and stuff. And I got a job working. Selling hot dogs and beer. And there were a lot of pavilions. The Vatican had a pavilion. Everybody had pavilions. And Johnson's Wax had a pavilion. And every afternoon at lunch, I would go to the Johnson's Wax pavilion because they had a movie that they showed that I adored. It was 20 minutes of that. And it was called To Be Alive. And it was three screens, kind of Cinerama-like, and it would show you the commonality of human experience in all of these different world cultures. So you saw kids playing in Japan, in Africa, in America. You saw weddings in all these different cultures. I mean, you saw joy. I mean, it talked about the joy of children and discovery. It talked about kids, you know, blowing a little dandelion and watching the little fluffy stuff float off. It was a movie that I don't know why it spoke to me. And at the end, or right near the end, it said, "To be alive is a wonderful thing." Something, I forget the exact words, but to be alive was what we're here for. And every time it would say that, I would start crying. And I would just start crying and go, and then they would show all the people really fast, you know, everywhere, having this wonderful life, really wonderful life. And all I knew is, I want to make movies that make people feel that. I want to do that. I want to bring that feeling into the world somehow, that it's an amazing thing to be alive. So I was recounting that story to Josh, and the thing that was amazing, it was made by a man named Francis Thompson, and Francis Thompson won an Oscar for it that year for Best Short Documentary. And years later, I got to work with him doing a documentary on the Cathedral of Chartres. And he and I just connected. There was heart to heart. And as a gift to me, I think it was my parting day or somewhere close to it, he showed me the last existing print of To Be Alive in my own private screening. So they had three projectors in their little screening room. And it was, you know, tiny room, but with big screens. And I had my own moment with that film. And as always, I sobbed at the end. And I sobbed at the miracle of life that brought me into a room with this filmmaker whose work I had loved and honored as a kid. Now I was working for him. And I thought, how does the universe work like this? How is it possible that I got to be with this man and be in his presence and have him present me all by myself this private screening? It was beautiful. So I was telling Josh this story, along with a lot of other stories. And I was trying to sum up the why my life had turned out for me to be so fulfilling. And the thing that kept coming to me, and I've talked about it here somewhat, and I know it's important, which is how often I gave up everything and risked everything for the next moment. I can't tell you how those choices occurred or why, but they were fundamental in bringing me what I now consider to be an amazing and fulfilling life. You know, I was working at NBC as an assistant film editor, and I had just taken LSD, and most of you have heard these stories, so I won't go into them, but even taking LSD was like this leap into the void, because I just felt there was something more out there, and there was. I mean, it turned everything around for me completely. And then I was at NBC, and I had this job that was clearly a career path, you know, becoming a film editor, and they were lifting me up from rank to rank and giving me more money, and it was really a wonderful, wonderful job. And there came a point where we were doing a documentary called JFK Remembered. He had been dead for 2 years. And they asked me if I would work on it, and if I did, they would give me overtime. And I had announced to them that I was going to be leaving this job to go travel, to India. But they said, look, here, we're going to give you a job that's going to be overtime, so much overtime that you have to go stay at the Hilton Hotel across the street because you're going to get 4 hours sleep, and you can just run over there and sleep and come back and keep working. So that's what I did, and I made... not a lot. I mean, those days it was $2,000, a little more, but I paid off some debts. And when it was over, I said, they offered me a higher position. I said, I'm leaving. I'm going off to India, or actually at that point to Greece. I was on the beginning of a voyage of what I called coming to know who I was, to make friends with myself. That was really the journey. I wanted to make friends with myself because I liked everybody else, but I didn't like me very much. And I thought, let me spend time with me. So I began this journey that took me to Greece, and I can go on forever with stories because they were amazing and wonderful, but I realized in Greece, nope, this isn't where I'm supposed to be. And I went off to India and a journey around the world looking for a spiritual teacher, but I had given up a really good job. And I came back to America, and before I arrived, I was in Japan, and I was sitting on the floor of a record store in Tokyo and listening to the music that had emerged in the year and a half I was gone. And two big albums were really central. One was Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and the other was Jefferson Airplane's Gracie Slick, Surrealistic Pillow, with a song on Surrealistic Pillow that completely focused my journey, and it was, Don't You Need Somebody to Love? And I said, yes. And then I did something really odd, and Blanche has a hard time with me telling this story, but it's really a funny, interesting story, because it doesn't feel romantic, but trust me, it's romantic. I said to God, I want somebody to love. Bring her into my life. Whoever you bring through the door, I will love. I will love her, if she'll love me. And so I got back to New York. I stayed with Tara's parents, George and Cheryl. And one of the first things they said to me was, do you want to meet a girl? And I said, yes. And Blanche walks in the room. And I went, is this the person? I mean, I had an image that I was looking for, you know, and Blanche was not exactly the image, but she was real and human and wonderful. And I went home with her that night. And I said, I'm going to tell you a story, which is the one I just told you, plus a lot more. And what I did is what I call peel the onion, only I didn't peel the onion because most people take a lifetime to do that. I just went, I cut the onion open and said, this is who I am. 3 hours it took. And I told her about... yeah, <yes. laughs> I do have a gift of gab. But at the end of it, she thought I was totally crazy and thought, how could I give up this guy? And we've been together ever since. So I call it an arranged marriage. But it couldn't have been arranged by anybody or anyone more amazing. And so here we are. And then I got a job. I got a job at the Whitney Museum after many other jobs, including the one with Francis Thompson. And I became a curator at the Whitney Museum. And Rudy died. And I thought, I need to continue my spiritual practice. It became far more important than career. And we were going to try to build an ashram in New York City. And we gave up our apartment in New York. We had a loft, a beautiful loft, for $80 a month. It was rent-controlled, incredible place. And we gave it up to move to this place on Broadway and 13th Street, but that place never came together. And we told our people in our building, we changed our mind. They said, you can't change your mind. You're gone. They didn't want us back. It was a special building, and they were angry that we were leaving it. So we had nowhere to go, and Michael Shoemaker in Indiana, who was one of Rudy's students, said, well, come here. Come here, you can be with us. And so we moved to Indiana on what I call a journey of spiritual romanticism. I decided I'm giving up everything for my spiritual life. I don't advise that to anybody. It's really a mistake to do that. On the other hand, it was not a mistake, because it announced to the universe in a very big way, in the same way that my journey to India had announced, I'm serious about this stuff. This is not a casual interest. I am willing to give up every ounce of security, everything that I have that grounds me to career, life, and I'm willing to leave it for this. And my spiritual life kept opening. Really what kept opening was my heart. And in the ashram, I fell in love with so many people. I loved getting up in the morning and greeting 80-100 people, hugging everybody. It was really beautiful. But ultimately, it was not the place to be, and there's 10 million stories in that. But Blanche and I decided to follow her doctorate, and she got a job in DeKalb, Illinois, and we entered the wasteland of cornfields and flatlands in Illinois, where Blanche had work, but I didn't, and life was horrible. And I had the worst 4 years of my life, and I'm in my 40s, early, late 30s, early 40s. So you're thinking by that time, all of you who are in various sort of relationships to that age, I blew it. I've really blown it. It's not happening. You know, I couldn't make money. I tried getting work. Nobody wanted to hire me. What was I? I was a former museum curator, but that didn't mean much. I taught school. I taught college, public speaking. I mean, I did whatever I could, but nothing satisfied. And then I had a movie that I had written some years before actually got made, called Brainstorm. And Blanche and I went to Hollywood for the premiere of that. We had no money. We had to borrow money to go to the premiere. Even the producer had no money, so we all were put together in one big limo, 14 of us. And when we arrived at the premiere, it was like the car in the circus, you know, all the clowns keep coming out. And we all popped out of that car for the premiere. But while we were there, we had a lunch with a friend, a director named Brian De Palma, who's an old friend. And Brian said, Bruce, if you want this career, you got to move here. And we went back to Illinois, and Blanche went to her department head and quit her job. And I always talk about her. She took a picture of our house and printed it up, Xeroxed it, and with these little tags saying for sale, and this was the phone number to call. We sold our house, and we moved to L.A. with me in a state of total shock and panic with no money. We had enough money to live for 2 months, period, and two kids. And we just went, and everything happened. You know, we're sitting in what happened. You know, I found the right soil. The roots went down. I was in my 40s before anything, early 40s, before anything started to happen. And then it just happened. And I think it happened because we took that leap of faith. We leaped into the void over and over and over. And every time we leaped into the void, we were caught. We were just caught. When Josh said to me, how come you're trusting me on this trip? Why are you so ready to leap into the void on this? And I said, the biggest leap into the void I ever had was having you. You know, I mean, that was the big one. Having a child is the most terrifying of all of these, and the most exciting And here now I'm sitting with my son, having breakfast, and telling him exactly what I just told you, going through the litany of what was this life about, why did it work, why did it come together on any level. And it was time to leave. It was time to go to this surprise. And in Racine, Wisconsin now. And I'm going, okay. And we get in the car and we drive through Racine and it's snow everywhere and freezing cold and who knows what this is going to be. And Josh actually describes this better than I do, but we drive to this place, we passed a lot of industrial space and then some really beautiful houses, many of them boarded up on Lake Michigan. And we come to this place and it's like a museum area. And there's a Frank Lloyd Wright Museum. And in front of that was this strange structure. And I look at it and I go, I know that thing. What is that? I said, oh my God, that looks like that building from the World's Fair. Mm-hmm. The Johnson's Wax Pavilion. And I'm looking at it and he drove around it and I said, so weird, why would that be here? I mean, it just made no sense at all. Why would that be here? And we're circling it, and I'm trying to get a sense of it. And he parks the car, and I step out of the car, still going, this what is this? Where am I? What is this? And I keep looking at this. It's like a flying saucer with these arches, and I go, that isn't like the pavilion in New York. That is the pavilion from upstate New York, and I go, are they showing that movie? I look at Josh and I go, oh, can they be showing that movie? It hasn't been seen in 40 years anywhere. 50. And I'm just like, and I start crying. You know, like, oh my God, I'm getting to see this movie to be alive again. And we walk in and they're waiting for me. And Josh had planned this all ahead. They had a book about the film. They had a little pavilion and a little plastic case that they were giving me as a gift. And my heart is just racing. And this museum is open one day a week on Fridays in the winter. And they are going to have the screening. And there were like 15 people in there. And we walk inside. And this movie from when I was 20 years old, 25 years old, starts to play. And I am now 70 years old, watching it from the other end of the spectrum. And the minute it starts to play, the tears just start flowing. And my whole life, everything that I care about, I mean, this movie, I realized as I'm watching it, it set up my whole career. It set up my entire feeling about life in the world. It expressed the sense of joy that I have in being alive. It just put it, it's like it was living right in front of me. And I just watched this movie now as a 70-year-old man. And at the end of the movie, there's a old man and his grandchild sitting in a canoe, exploring the world through each other's eyes and experiencing it in exactly the same way Talia and I experienced the world together. And I was heaving with sobs, just heaving with the enormity of what this feels like. And the perfection of having had a child who would know this about me and who would think that I would want this and know that it would be a gift that I would care about. And to have been known by someone at all in life, you all know what a rare thing that is. I mean, it almost never happens. And there I was, having been known and seen and touched by the child that Blanche and I brought into the world. And the symmetry of this, the beauty of all of this, the perfection of this moment, everything adding up. Everything coming together in a way of saying, yes, yes, this is for you. This is for you to be alive. To be alive. That's all it was about. And it was the best 70th birthday gift I could have received, except for the fact that it continued all that day into all of yesterday and into this moment. It has been perfection upon perfection upon perfection, gift upon gift upon gift. And I know in some ways you might look at me and say, well, why were you singled out? Why can't I have that? It doesn't work that way. You are having that. It may not come exactly in those terms. It may not be somebody giving you specifically that gift, but they are giving you life. You are alive. To be alive. That's the gift. To be alive. And one of the great things you realize when you turn 70 is who is in your life? Who's there? And you find, on some level, either it's not as many people as you had expected. I think it's really a relatively small group of people who are in your life. And I am blessed to have all of you in my life. Last night I had my whole family here, my whole, you know, all of, you know, the cousins, everybody who's part of my family. And it was quite clear last night, and I talked about it, I'm now the patriarch of this family. What I wanted last night more than anything was for my mom and dad to be here to see it. You know, I thought, whoa, that would have been really wonderful. In fact, I remember at my Aunt Esther's 75th birthday, I gave her a framed picture of her parents. I don't know why. Blanche and I just found it and we had it framed and it was really beautiful. And so she's opening presents and all of a sudden she opens our presents and she starts just weeping. And she said, I never expected to see them here. And I totally got that. I don't know why we want our parents to be there to see us in the joy of our old age, but they deserve to know how well it turned out. They deserve to know what a good ride it was. So, I am so grateful that you're in my life. You have no idea. You know, I mean, some people want and dream of a very big stage, you know, that stadium I talked about, and believe me, we'll all get a taste of that. But what we really want is for the people in your life to be there for you and just to show up and to realize they're going to bring you craziness and chaos and incompletion and drama and frustration and obstacle and love and beauty and moments of incredible touching quality. You're going to get everything. When we had a party last night, I wanted all the little kids to come because we now have all these little grandchildren. And we wanted them all to be there. And it was chaos. It was really chaos, but it was the most beautiful chaos you can imagine. I wouldn't have wanted it to be anything but that. And it was beautiful because we had, you know, adults who all cared and who all appreciated being together. All of the family tensions were there exactly as they'd have to be. You know, it should never be otherwise. And it was completely perfect. It was perfect. And that's all I can tell you is your life is perfect. I know you don't believe me. Because you can't. You can't believe me. You go the endless but. And all I can tell you is at some point that but falls away. It just falls away. And even more dramatically and surprisingly, on some occasion, even you fall away. And I would think that when the Bruce that I've known all these years fell away, that this kind of talk wouldn't happen. I would be here as some pure saint talking about, you know, I don't know whatever pure saints talk about. But what you really discover is you're the whole thing. You're the totality. You're a pure saint and you're a completely messed up human being. You know, you have shoulder pains and you feel like your heart is bursting and you love every molecule of existence. All of this is happening simultaneously. It's all alive, it's all real, it's all immediate. thinking of the next moment is not important. I had a great moment with Talia yesterday. I'll try to wind this up. I mean, this little girl, she's now become not only my teacher, my professor. And I did this thing yesterday with her. I didn't think about it. I was talking about my being 70, and I tried to show her how much 70 was. And, you know, you ask her how old she is, and she goes, 2. And she's now kind of figured out that she's moving toward 3. And I said, well, I am 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, 35, 50, 50, 60, 65, 70. And I did that whole trip with her. And then I said, one day, you're going to be all of that. And I counted it out again. And I said, you're going to be a woman with gray hair and all. I tried to give her the future. And she started to cry. And she said, I want to be Talia. And she just wanted to be what she was. And trust me, that's the beginning of a clarity for me that I've never had. We want to be what we are. Forget this future thing. It's terrifying. Nobody can face the future. We don't know what that is. You know? And she said it to me so clearly. Stop that. Let me be 2. Be with me as 2. And we will have a wonderful time. And in truth, she is the greatest pleasure of my life, as you all know, and teaches me minute by minute. But now she's teaching me way beyond my skill level. And I'm proving to be a rather, incompetent grandpa. But I really am learning the lessons of from her. And so that's the great thing. You hit 70 and you start to learn what life means when you're 2. And that's the lesson you kind of knew at 2. And have to relearn. That's all you have to do. Go back to the purity of that, and life will lead you there if you are willing to follow. It will lead you back. Ultimately, it will strip stuff away. You may think it's a loss of stuff, but trust me, you'll be so glad to get rid of it. The baggage of your life falls away. This pure little being, if you're lucky, just starts to radiate outward, and you become this old, simple person. And you no longer have career needs, you no longer have stuff that you know that you need, and if you can get past this regret for stuff that didn't happen, you know, let it fall away. You had a life. You still have a life. The sun still rises. You know, you can still look at the worms crawling in the grass. You know, there's still a world of amazement if you are willing to open to that and live that life. And that's the teaching of being 70. That's what you come to. 70 isn't about just looking back. It's looking at this right now. That's the whole lesson. Forget what was. Forget what will be. This is it. You're in it. You're it. And everyone around you is your totality. Everyone. That's who you are. Love them or hate them, they're yours. And this is your life. And, you know, who knows? I may have, you know, another so many years and talk about this at 80 or 90, I have no idea, but I don't think the lesson will be much different. I really don't. I think the lesson is the cliche of all times, live for today. That's the lesson. And so you can all go, yeah, I've heard that before. But I'm telling you, learn that lesson. That's all there is. So I don't know if I should open this up for questions. It's been so long. And
thank you, Bruce.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Appreciate it. I really love you guys. I mean, I hope you feel it, but I really love you guys. And I mean one on one on one on one on one on one and collectively. I've been given a very big heart, and it's very capable of fulfilling the love that you need. So thanks for being here.
Thank you.